You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
There are times when there just aren't enough hours in the day to get everything done. And when it comes to this past month, it often felt like there weren't enough days to do everything I needed to do. I was producing a concert at 54 Below, I was learning a new musical for a stage reading, not to mention auditioning, as well as putting together this podcast and my other theater history podcast, Closing Night. And on top of all that, I had to take my landlord to court to get repairs done in my apartment, which honestly has been a months-long process. So suffice to say, I've had a lot on my plate. In fact, I've had many plates going. But everything I've just mentioned is about the day-to-day stuff we have to get done. But then there's the life stuff, the personal things that we go through and have to process and handle, along with that ever-growing to-do list. And in this episode, my guest and I will discuss how that life stuff, you know, those important things, will eventually take the driver's seat, whether we want them to or not.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gettelfinger. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky. I split my time now between Southern Indiana, Louisville, Kentucky, and New York City, and I am an actor and a teacher.
Sarah's Broadway debut came in 2000 with the musical Seussical. And she worked steadily on Broadway through the years until she and I met and worked together on the Addams Family National Tour in 2011. But then she had to take a break from acting, a break from New York City as well. And except for an off-Broadway musical in 2014, Sarah has had to focus on her life and let the career she loves so much take a back seat. But now she's back on Broadway in a new musical, Water for Elephants, that opened at the Imperial Theater on March 21st. We sat down during the preview process of that show, and she openly talks about the struggles and warning signs that led up to her long absence, as well as the lessons she had to learn both personally and professionally.
It's like you're demanding that I let go of trying to be perfect and actually do the work. So it was really strange. It was almost like the first time somebody demanded that I let go of trying to be perfect.
Welcome to another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, an award-winning theater podcast. I'm Patrick Oliver Jones, a New York actor and singer, and each week I talk with fellow artists about personal setbacks and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can donate, subscribe, and find past episodes. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com. Well, welcome, Sarah. It is so good to see you again. So good to have you on the podcast. I'm excited for our conversation today.
Me too. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's been so long. Like that was 12 years ago, 13 yes. years ago when we were on Addams Family Tour together.
Yes. Yes.
Oh my gosh. It feels like a lifetime ago. I mean, I was just in a different place. I was like, my life just seems so different. It was my first like big New York gig that I booked. So it was a different time.
Very much the same. I feel like I've lived four lifetimes since then. So I'm glad that we're both here now and doing well.
Right. Exactly. Well, we'll get started with the first story that you wanted to share. And I think any actor can relate to this, being in the rehearsal process. And you say that you got your ass ripped by Rob Ashford while you were playing Fastrada in Pippin. Now, this was because of your inability to embrace the process.
Yes.
Now, what was this process he wanted you to embrace?
Well, it actually was one of the most life-changing, tough love moments that I still probably on a regular basis, I will remember this. And it makes me want to like send him a fruit basket. it's one of those things where you look back. And I was just over a year out of college. I had gotten my equity card doing the Fosse tour. And I left the Fosse tour to go do this Pippin at Paper Mill Playhouse. You know, this always had lots of promise to possibly come in, things like that. And they weren't even going to let me audition. They're like, there's no way. She's too young. And I just said, you know, my agent, I was like, you got to let me come in. You got to let me go in. You got to let me go in. And so I ended up booking this thing. And it was a big deal, you know, because I, you know, obviously I had been getting indoors as a dancer. But also, you know, she had this fabulous song, this fabulous scene. And, you know, and I'm literally like 23 years old and playing this really important part. Jack Noseworthy is playing Pippin. And it was a big deal. But I'd also just come out of conservatory, very much in this perfectionist headspace. And, you know, that number, Spread a Little Sunshine, is a bit of a marathon. You know, you sing, you dance, you stop, you do the scene, you sing, you dance, stop, you do the scene. And the bottom line was, I'm in there trying to do it. I'm getting winded. We're rehearsing at 890 Broadway back then. And I was having trouble. And I was getting angry. And even though I was angry at myself, I was getting, you know, just frustrated and almost in tears and just, you know. And like the women in that ensemble were like, it's many of them still so dear to me today, like these goddesses of musical theater, like Roxanne Barlow, Amy Higgins, Wendy Waring. And I'm sitting here, you know, damn near having a fit because I'm running out of air. And I remember Rob stopping the rehearsal. And he said, I need everybody to leave except for Sarah.
Oh, boy. Now, did you think you're in trouble?
I knew he wasn't going to congratulate me. I mean, I didn't know because it was tense and it was my fault, you know. And he said, look, you are one of the most talented young performers I've come across in a long time. But I don't know where you came from. To where you have this notion that there's no process. Did you just supposed to come in and be perfect and there's no taking chances or no building up stamina? Instead, you just go into meltdown mode if it doesn't happen instantly. He said, but if you don't get over that real quick, your career's going to be over before it started. Yeah, and it wasn't in a, you know, you're so good. Don't be hard on yourself. It was very much in tone of, would you like to get your shit together or not? Because this is nonsense. And it was powerful. It was powerful. And what was interesting is Rob would hire me for Seussical. He would hire me again for The Boys from Syracuse. But in some ways, like, I don't know if I even started to totally figure that out for another, you know, 5 or 6 years. And I really didn't totally figure it out until after I completely crashed and burned, ended up leaving the business. And about 2 years ago is literally a different human. It was the first time that I think I truly understood what he meant and was able to not only apply it, but enjoy it. But like, I even remember, you know, a couple of years later when we were doing this number in Boys from Syracuse, where I was myself, Liz Mills, Deidre Goodwin, and Milena Govich. We were the courtesans and we're out here and to do this number where we're all sitting on these boxes and spinning and, you know, and it was hard. It was hard. And I remember one night being up there. And it was like, it wasn't going well. And I couldn't get my feet around. So I just out from the gut, Sarah. And I still, like, I know I drove him crazy, but he kept hiring me. I owe him so much for that because it's fascinating to look back on it because in so many ways, it was like I was behaving like a brat, But it wasn't a brat. It wasn't like a brat coming out at other people. It was just like I was so mad at myself. But, you know, when you look at it now, it's like, I don't need to know why. The point is you're shutting down right now instead of keeping at it. And it's not only pissing me off, it's wasting our time. So it was very profound, especially as I got older. It was like, oh, geez, I'm so sorry. You know what I mean? Like, it's like now I see, now I know. But it's really interesting how we can torture ourselves because we think we're failing.
Yeah, and it's absolutely. Like,
the only reason you're failing is because you won't give yourself permission to be imperfect right now. Can we get the fuck on with it? You know what I mean? So it's one of those things that I, even though I've gotten so much better at it, I really talk about that a lot when I teach. And I, you know, it was such a gift that he was trying to give me. In the moment, it wasn't a gift. It was like, listen, you little shit, we don't have time for this. But it was a gift, you know?
Right. It's one of those things like after the moment, you, as you said, maybe even years down the road, you start to really process what he was saying. But in the moment, you probably still heard it as, listen, you little twerp, you better get your act together. You better get, you probably heard it as him coming down on you, right? In some way?
It's not even so much that. Because it was this very, it was almost confusing. It was, I didn't know what to do with it because it was like, it was very forceful, but it was like this forceful demanding that I give myself permission to not be great at it right now. To give my, and so it was like, it's like you're demanding that I let go of trying to be perfect and actually do the work and let it be messy and find it out. And no, you don't have the stamina. I don't give a shit that you don't have the stamina right now. But instead of whining about it, why don't we start trying to build the stamina? So it was really strange. It was almost like the first time somebody demanded that I let go of trying to be perfect. You know, and so it was strange because I, you know, I did end up making progress, but it was sort of like this, I don't know, getting knocked on the head with like, I never thought about that. I thought I had to just come in and just add water and make it instant. And it was this person saying no, and that's not how we do good work.
It's you know, so hard to realize that. It's so hard to realize that letting go. And you're right. Even though you weren't getting mad at anyone else, you weren't taking it out on anyone else, you know, it was contained within yourself, but it still shows that energy that we're using to beat ourselves up and to push harder and to, you know, kind of yell at ourselves, that energy still comes through. And
it still poisons the room.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah. It took me a while to let go of that too. I thought I needed to control this. I would sometimes reach out to others and feel like, well, no, the show should be doing this. Or there were times where I would get, you know, kind of ahead of myself as well. And directors would be like, that's my job. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah. So early on, I had my opinions about things about myself, but then also about other things. But then whenever I soon came to realize that I needed to mess up in the room. I needed to like explore and be like, that is wrong. I need to get those flubs out. I need to get those wrong choices out. Because if I don't, guess where they come out? In the performance.
Right. Well, and so often, you know, especially, you know, when I've been very fortunate to have multiple times and but what I'm doing right now, like when you're creating something new, that's the only way you're going to find the best version. Because if you really get to the point where you know, as Rob said, you know, allow yourself to have a process. Actually, it's not very often that things are totally right or totally wrong in the creating of something. You can go down a road and maybe find a few things there. like that will keep, but I think there's a better way to explore that, or there's a better way to pair that with this, or what if we, you know, and even now when I do my own work, and certainly when I teach, and that's why I talk about using colors, because they're mixable, they're blendable, and I can pull a little more of this or take a little bit of that away. It's not a paint by numbers for me. And I think that back then I really, you know, but this is also before I got any notion of what would happen if instead of trying to measure up to others' marks or what you think other people want, you just tried operating from your authentic self and your authentic instrument. But these are things that we don't figure out sometimes until it's too late. But in my case, I'm very blessed that I, you know, but it is profound to look back on it and realize, you know, the paint by numberness of it, if you will.
That
it
really— Well, it's so interesting that you bring that up, because yeah, that paint by numbers means that within this space, you paint this color, within this next space, you paint, rather there are no lines, there are no spaces. It's a blending. As you said, it blends from one color to the next, from one moment to the next, as we portray these characters, because that's life. That's how we live our lives. And that's obviously what we have to bring to our characters, our own life and the life that that they live.
Yes, for sure.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Well, as we get into story number two, you wanted to talk about getting let go from Grey Gardens when it transferred from Playwrights Horizons to Broadway. Now, I'm curious, how did you find out that you weren't going to be moving on with the show?
Well, it was very interesting, because if I have to look back, because, you know, the next thing that, you know, we'll talk about is, you know, how I ended our time at the Addams Family. But looking back, it's strange, because that production off-Broadway of Grey Gardens, in some ways, I am most proud of the work I did in that. I really feel like I did a lot of important, beautiful work in that production. It was an unbelievable gift of a daily masterclass to be with and watching Christine and Mary Louise. But I think some of the work that I was able to do in that show came from using a lot of pain that was coming very big within me. And it was a great resource for what the character went through. But again, you've got to be very careful with that, because there is a difference between just sort of being this walking wound on stage and almost like using your performance and the stage and your community and your company backstage is like this open rogue therapy ground that's a little reckless and not very responsible or respectful to your other cast members. And I was kind of a mess. I mean, I did the shows I did them well, but I remember being deeply unhappy. I had definitely, looking back, started really depending on drugs and alcohol. And, you know, there's always different chemistry things and frustration things, because that was another one that was new and we're trying to build it and figure it out. But something that I look back on too was, if things are going well, or say that you're not jiving with the co-star or whatever, there was just so much anger. I was just so angry.
Was it at yourself? Was it at the process, the business?
I think it was everything. I think it was everything, because it's just, there are things that, especially now where I'm at in my life, I realize, like, when there's deeper pain and different things that are really in turmoil within you, you're never going to be totally in the clear to do healthy work. You know what I mean? And healthy doesn't mean good or bad. Just in a place of truth or clarity where it couldn't potentially be loaded with other things. And especially, again, I was still pretty young. You have to be very careful when it's just like, I have all this darkness and struggle and deep things, you know, that I'll use it in the show. And it's like, yeah. And sometimes it's effective, but it doesn't mean that it's totally healthy. And I've now learned that you can absolutely use real pain and real experience, but there is a big difference between doing it as a technician and sort of funneling it through in a professional, technical way, as opposed to just going out on stage, like I said, like this walking wound, and just sort of vomiting in, you know, and not even necessarily that it's over gratuitous, but I have found in my experience, there can be something very dangerous about just literally going out there with raw pain or emotion that you're actually navigating in life and working it out in front of an audience at the expense of your company member. It's not real fair.
Well, and it's not real acting. I mean, as visceral as it can be, I mean, the tears will be real, the anger will be real, whatever it is. But you're right. It's a bit unhinged. It's a bit, it's a bit uncertain, both from yourself, but then your fellow actors. I remember there was one time where we had a matinee performance of Camelot. I was Lancelot. And my girlfriend at the time broke up with me at 11 a.m. that morning. Uh-huh. So when I'm singing If Ever I Would Leave You, I mean, what else am I going to do but live that moment?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it was a very different performance from all my other ones, you know.
Oh, sure.
But at the same time, yeah, there was one point at which the Guinevere, she knew what I was going through. And there was one moment where it wasn't blocked that way, but we're in the midst of a scene and I'm breaking down. I'm not supposed to be crying. I'm Lancelot, but I'm breaking down. And she hugs me in the middle of this scene. And so we're just living a life on the stage.
Right. Yes.
Oh.
And it's, you know, it was a lot. And but the thing was too, I think that, like, I do know that it's very sweet, because I know that it was sort of a mixed camp on whether or not to have me continue. But I will say this, Michael Greif, I learned so much from him in that process, but also I will always have such a deep care and respect for him, because he called me. It was funny. I had just left my therapist's office, and it was one of those that, looking back, it was like that therapist couldn't have helped me if she wanted to, because I was never in a place of, like, total honesty, you know, with her. But I was standing in the elevator, and, you know, you hear the rumblings, and Michael called me directly and said, "Hi, you know, I've got to talk to you." And I said, "Can I guess? It's transferring." He said, "Yes." And I said, "And I'm not going with it." And he said, "No." And he started to get very emotional, and he asked if he could meet me. later because I had been, I'd taken a leave of absence from Dirty Rotten. And then he asked if we could meet. And I remember he took me to dinner to Lucia. And he, you know, very upset. He said, fought for you when it's so bad. You know, I'm so heartbroken. But it was one of those things where it's like, to call me directly, to sit down at, you know, at a restaurant with me and just really say, be honest and say, you know, this was a terribly difficult decision. And to see that that person was genuinely upset, whether it was, you know, ultimately going to be upset that I wasn't the actor, but clearly cared about me enough and valued what I had given to that part of production enough to take that time with me. And then the other thing that was really cool is one of our producers, Beth Williams, and she sent me the most beautiful, beautiful flowers, just said, you know, I'm so sorry. This is not what I wanted to have happen. But I believe in you, and I know that we are meant to cross paths again. Beth is one of our lead producers on Water for Elephants. And I had not seen her really. It was almost 20 years later when I walked in that room, you know, when the Water for Elephants thing. So it was really cool. It was really profound. But it was interesting. I was lucky enough to get very close to Cheetah when I did Nine back in 2003, you know, I was devastated and I called her and I remember she took me to Joe Allen and told her what happened and she listened. She said, are you done? You know, and not in like a shut up way, but just like, did you get all that out? And she said, okay, so you got fired. One, congrats, darling. You officially have a real career. And two, what do we do now? And it was, you know, it was this beautiful combination of, I hear you. I'm sorry. But if you want to do this for a long time, It's going to be up and down, and there are going to be roads that you don't get to continue with. But on we go, you know, because I think that was sort of also her way of, you can't dwell on it, because if you dwell on it too long, it will just result in, you know, being very embittered. And it's like you can't do anything but look forward. You know, and again, I wouldn't say that it was directly because of Grey Gardens, because some of the demons that I was already starting to battle, you know, I think just were starting to really get solid during that time. But again, in retrospect, you see and you understand, you know.
Yeah. Were you able to get right back into auditions again and go for the next thing? Or did you have to take a moment after Grey Gardens?
I took a moment. Well, I took a big moment. It wasn't necessarily, you know, I didn't have something where I'm like, you know, I'm leaving the business. But it was really wild because what would come up was an opportunity. You know, the group Il Divo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they wanted to do sort of a version of that where they put together, it was with Universal Records, and they put together a classical crossover trio that was an opera singer, a pop singer, and a Broadway singer. And I ended up auditioning for that and booked that and became a member of this trio called the Three Graces. And then I ended up kind of going on this 2-year adventure where it was a lot of Los Angeles, some international travel. And in some ways, I mean, that was extraordinary. You know, it's like getting to work with people like David Foster and Desmond Child and, you know, just even going into some of those recording studios in LA and the other, you know, just even mainstream artists that were, had been there. It was just like being in a church. I mean, it was incredible. But I missed acting so much, and my, you know, struggles would continue. So it was one of those things where I think I sort of had this, oh, well, maybe this all happened for a reason because I meant to try this other thing. And I did, and I think it had its place, but it also became very difficult and stressful. And, you know, I think it was just sort of another chapter in no matter where you run, there you are.
You know? we can never get away from ourselves. That is true.
For sure, so.
Yeah, because with Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, that had, I mean, you had been steadily working on Broadway from 2000 to 2006. And so Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was kind of the culmination and really a big part for you, a next step forward in your career. So was there this expectation that you should now be at this level? So when Grey Gardens didn't happen, it was like a failure of that?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think absolutely in my mind. And more than, you know what it was too, is that more than anything, and again, because of just the other demons that had really started to take hold, for me, I loved that part. I loved that part so much. And I'm still, you know, Daddy's Girl. I mean, I remember like when Scott Frankel was building that, just getting to stand at the piano with him. I mean, that was just, I will treasure that, those memories forever. But for me, and again, you talk about like the inside confidence versus trying to get it from the outside. You know, I'm not only in this show that I loved the part, but I'm out there with Mary Louise Wilson and Christine Ebersole. And if that is not a feeling of like, oh my God, you know, this has to be, you know, it's like I just to stand next to them made it feel like this is everything I ever want to be. But it was interesting because it's like, you're so busy putting this pressure on yourself to be able to stand next to them or to be like them that I was still so far away from having that profound awakening of the only way you're ever going to come close to becoming a Mary Louise Wilson or a Christine Ebersole is if you wake up at one day, I'm getting choked up, and realize how miraculous it would be if you were just your best Sarah fucking Gettelbaker. You, as you are, with your own superpowers, your own flaws, but only one you, for better or for worse. And that's the magic that those women have, you know. And I am feeling that now. But just now, and in 4 days, I'll be 47 years old. You know, better late than never, but it is profound. And again, when I work with people, like we chase and chase and chase, trying to sound like, be compared to, it's like, that ain't it. That ain't it. You know,
that is so. It's so tough to not only realize that, but then to actually apply it. Because when we're in our 20s, when we're teenagers, high school, college age, when we're coming up, we're listening to these cast recordings. We're listening to these artists. We're watching them perform. And it's like, that's the role that I want to do, or the songs I want to sing, or the type of characters I want to play. And so we're seeing constantly what we want to be.
Yes.
And so we're constantly looking outward and have a goal that's beyond us that we keep reaching for. And it is... You're right. It is so hard to turn that eye around to us and be like, that's who you need to be.
Yeah.
That's who you need to bring to the stage. That's the songs that need to come from you. That's what you need to be singing. And that, it is so tough to own that.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the reason now when I teach, I talk a lot about like, we got to start with this, with head and heart. Not in like a, you know, Stuart Smalley bumper sticker way, but like what I will say, Who do you love? Who do you want to listen to? Who do you want? And I say, let me tell you why you really love them. You know, not in a like, I'm going to tell you your thoughts, but then I talk about the power of being your fullest you. You know, and it is amazing if you can get just even kids to consider that, you know, it's not because they're scrouting an E. It's not because it's because, you know, they are being their fullest Sutton. They are being their fullest Josh Henry. They are being their fullest, you know, Leslie Odom Jr. They're, you know, all these people that you guys are, you know, and I guarantee some of them probably, you know, will tell you the same stories, that it's like when you will harness your superpowers when you realize there's only one you. And that's when you start to be like, hey, and it's, I really, really, it would have been a game changer. So I really try to make sure that I lay that on the ground level, or even just keep reminding, because there's some stuff that you just don't get until you grow up and you live and you do it wrong 1,000 times, you
right,
know,
right.
But if it's somewhere in the corner, instead of like, this is what you have to do, it's like, no, it isn't. I don't have to do anything, you know? So, and I mean, not in like an obstinate way, but in a like, trust me, there, you know, it's like we truly can only do what we can, or you're running a race you could never possibly win.
Yeah. It's so interesting to listen to recording artists. I think this is one of the clearest examples. When I listen to a recording artist, you know, they're doing their own songs or, you know, but then they do a cover version. I've only heard it this way. I've only, you know, I remember the original artist, but then they do a cover and completely turn it into their version. And it's so interesting to hear these old lyrics and old melodies in their voice and their, and it's like they discovered who they are, what they bring to a song, and how this old standard from the 60s can now mean something in 2024.
It's on, and it shows that longevity of like beautiful material can be inhabited in multiple ways by multiple creatures, you know.
The three stories shared in this episode are only part of the conversation. Subscribers get early access to the full interviews with guests, not only including these stories, but audition stories as well. Join Why I'll Never Make It and help support this podcast, as well as learn more about the guests and the lessons they've learned. Go to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or find the link in the show notes. And another benefit of being a subscriber, you won't have to listen to any ads either.
Death is just around the corner, waiting high upon the hill. Someone buried in an avalanche. Ooh, that's the kind of gig I can really dig. Marriage often disappoints you. Not each husband is a gem. So I'll mourn, knowing death is just around the corner, coming after them.
Well, we've been kind of talking about it for a bit, but as we get into story number three, this deals with when we met, our wonderful time at Adam's Family, such a wonderful year and a half together on the road.
Yeah.
And with the ending of that tour, which was the end of 2012, you finally came to realize that you needed to get help for substance abuse.
For sure.
You've alluded to it before in the shows we've been talking about, but what was the light bulb at this particular moment?
I mean, and you're very kind, but I mean, I was struggling months before we ended that tour. I was struggling. And I just happened to be in a group of people where the majority of people, you know, I know it was being discussed. I know that I was not remotely bringing what I could or should to the table, especially by the end of it. And I was just lucky enough to either have people that were supportive or had enough compassion to be patient and kind. But like, I still have so many regrets because, you know, I was one of the in the position to be one of the leaders of that company. And while I think everyone knew my heart was in the right place, I brought our show down. I was, you know, not reliable. And even when I was out there, there were times when I, you know, looking back, had no fucking business being out there, you know. And I, especially with Doug Sills, really, really later on, you know, as I was going in recovery, like, just really needed to apologize for that, especially because Doug, more than anyone, you know, really knew I needed help. And even in the years after that, you know, has still remained very loving and checked in because, you know, we closed in Costa Mesa and I didn't even make it to our closing party because I couldn't leave my dressing room. I had to beg our company manager not to call, you know, not to have me go to the emergency room because I was just like still in that mentality of like, no, I'll get in trouble. I have to go home, you know, and I was just like, just please leave me alone. And I think I was in that dressing room for like 3 hours on the floor in the bathroom, just trying to get back to the hotel to try and get on a plane. I mean, it was just, when I look back at that person, you know, it just, it's heartbreaking. And in some ways, while, you know, it went on to be like my greatest shame for a long time, in some ways, the fact that I made it off of that tour alive, like, saved my life. It would start what I call the truly the beginning of the end of what was literally my former life in all possible ways, because I went back home to, I mean, I went back to New York, and within 2 months of that tour closing, I had to wave the white flag and finally call my parents and call my family and say, I'm not going to survive this. I have to leave New York. I have to, you know, and what would follow absolutely ended up leaving New York, going home, going through the picnic of, you know, rehab, detox, trying to get sober. And that was tough. And then, you know, I tried to come back to New York for a minute. I was doing a show called Atomic,
which I saw. I remember.
Also very challenging, beautiful people, but it was very challenging. It was not received well. And after that, I kind of realized this was too soon. I'm not, you know, if I ever want to have a shot at doing this again, I've got to truly go away and figure out how to live, because I'm feeling too shaky, you know. Well, then what would happen is I go back, kind of really starting to focus on, you know, how to stay sober, things like that. And then I end up on several medicines that are supposed to help me with depression or supposed to help me, you know, stay clean. But the worst my life ever got was when I was just about 2 years sober, because it would turn out that one of the depression meds they put me on that was supposed to help me made me crazier than I had ever been and I was using. So there was this, I mean, my life just totally crashed and burned, totally crashed and burned. Lost everything, was strange for my family. I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, I'm just like, I'm not using drugs and alcohol, and I'm the worst person I've ever been. You know, by the grace of God, there would be a series of events where I would discover what was going on with this medicine. Upon getting off of it, it was like this spell was broken, and I started to rebuild my life. And in the years that would follow, I mean, I was away from the business for almost 11 years. And, you know, I started enjoying the benefits of sobriety. My grade school sweetheart that I had not seen in 30 years, who also had had some life challenges and moved back home, like actively sought me out. We've now been together over 6 years, married for three. The first way I started sort of opening my heart to music again was I started teaching preschool with like a specialty in music. And that was a gift. And then slowly as I just sort of started, and I was never thinking about performing, but slowly as I started just sort of enjoying being a happy, fulfilled human being, people started going, understanding what had happened to me and that it was safe to be around me again. And then suddenly people started coming out of the woodwork to ask for a voice lesson, to ask for a dance class, to ask for a monologue coaching. And then I slowly was able to, my heart, even consider dealing with this thing that I had loved so much for so long. And it really gave me this new awakening, also seeing it through like a teacher's eyes of like, helping these kids do it the right way, and not just in terms of technique, but to really take care of their spirits and their breath and in their being kind to themselves and being patient with themselves. And then very slowly, you know, because, you know, you can't teach without doing. And so it's also, I'm now realizing, as I'm just sort of even demonstrating things here and there, I don't like truly, because even though like there were several years when I was still hadn't gone into like the full blown height of my addiction, you know, I still partied here and there, but I'm suddenly dealing with this instrument that is cleaner and stronger than it's ever been. I mean, quite truly, it's just never been this clear. And I still hadn't, would never consider, you know, going back. But then right after the pandemic, we had a 20-year Seussical original cast Zoom reunion. And somebody said, you know, next year we gotta do a 54 below. We gotta do a 54 below. And I remember thinking then, like, oh God, what is that, something my heart could take? And then it came around. And, you know, and thankfully, you know, my parents are back in my life. My husband was so wonderful and supportive. What ended up happening was Michelle Paulk was not able to do it. And I had understudied Maisie back when we did it. And so they asked me to do Maisie. And I was not thinking about it. It's like, oh, it's going to be my big return. You know, like I didn't call, my parents were there. My husband were there. And like two of my really good friends. But it was, I was truly going back up thinking, well, what a beautiful end. Like, at least I'll have a nice end to that time of my life, you know, because it was my first Broadway show. It'll be a nice end. And then suddenly, as I start working on it, it was like, oh my God, I've never been able to do this like this before. To just be able to do anything I want with my voice, anything I want with my body. And I'm present and calm and just, it's just joyous. I come up, I do this concert. People were overwhelmingly responsive. My husband was weeping. He was like, I don't care what we have to do. You're giving your notice to preschool because you're not fucking done. And like 2 months later, when I had promised him after the holidays, I would reach out to my old agent, like 3 days before I had marked it on the calendar that I promised I was going to do it. She called me. She's like, excuse me, are you back? And did you do a Seussical concert? People are telling me you did the Seussical concert. What is going on? And I'm sitting in a Broadway dressing room right now. Like, it's crazy. Crazy, like literally not since the Lord Jesus himself has there been a rolling back of the rock. I cannot even tell you, but you know, stuff that is, you know, things find their way in their own time. And it's just every day is the fucking bonus round, man. You know, it really, really is. So
yeah, I've certainly had my own addictive issues, and I've been in therapy for that. How much was therapy a part of your own recovery?
You know what? It was therapy was a lot of it, but honestly, for me, I try to be respectful of the anonymity of things, but it was the community of those rooms, you know, and the meetings. And also the other thing too, because I don't attend meetings nearly as often as I did, but what's astounding is there's just so many people now. I cannot believe how many people I encounter that, like, with very minimal interaction, it's like, oh yeah, me too. You know, and it really takes very little to find, you know, like that thing in common and support. And it's really, I think it's like spiritual health and the community. And for me, because it was a little tricky with especially because I think there was some mistrust, especially with some of the stuff that, you know, I was put on via some of that kind of stuff. And like now it's just sort of I take Advil when I need it and nothing else. And other than that, you know, you pick up the phone and have a conversation with somebody that gets it, you know, more just peer to peer. And it's, you know, there's just a very simple clarity in it, you know.
What would you say is the biggest difference between the addicted Sarah and now the sober Sarah?
I know this sounds really strange, but it's like I'm always here. I'm here. I'm present. And that has been profound in doing this show, and especially even doing things like the conversation we're having now, or interviews and press, or even just doing the show every night. What is completely missing is that panicked rewinding of the tape. How did it go? What did I say? How did I come off? And it's like, I was there. I was fully present and there. And like, especially in the interviews and stuff, when you see it back, it's like, yep, that's what I said. And that's how I felt. And especially like in the performance of it, not only is there no, oh, was that good? Was that, you know, it's like, you were there the whole time. You were clear and present. And newsflash, I fucking enjoyed it. You know what I mean? And like, it sounds so crazy to say that, but like, that was the biggest piece that was missing. But again, it goes back to chasing that outside approval, where it's like, if I come off after a show, and I need to know that A, B, and C, or the powers that be, did you think I was good? Was it good? And it's really screwed up, because it's like, A, even if you say, because I can't even say, well, if you liked it, then I can say I enjoyed it. That's not me enjoying a work experience. That's me being damn near just relieved that I've gotten approval for something that shouldn't be my ultimate indicator. You know, so that is truly the biggest thing. It's like, I'm there for it. Like, and I don't mean it like I'm there for it. You know what I mean? But like, I'm present. And it sounds so cliche, but like the profound difference, I can't even tell you, you know.
Yeah, there's nothing simple about being in the moment, being present, I'm really enjoying this. Like, I mean, we get to play pretend on stage. We get to play these characters. Again, it's called playing the character, to really embrace that and inhabit that playfulness, that fun. Even if you're doing a serious part that has a lot of trauma to it, there's still an enjoyment of delving in, enriching these characters, getting an audience to react to it.
Your scene partners.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's funny because the other night we're in preview. So there's new lines here and there and stuff. And again, this is new Sarah, you know, it's like, what? Oh, I hope I, you know, and I'm like, and then I go, are you going to know what to say? Because your friend is going to talk to you and you're going to answer them. Like, it's very, you know what I mean? It's like, you don't have to like keep it all up here. Like, what are my lines in order? And like, wait for their kids. It's like, you're going to go out and you're going to sit on the box and your friends are going to talk to you and you're going to listen to what they say. And it will be very clear what you're supposed to say back. You know what I mean? Which is really just good acting. You know what I mean? But it's so crazy how we get away from that, you know, or even if it's not like with other, like those specific demons, but when we get into that chase mode of there's this subconscious thing where I'm doing the best I can in the show because hopefully it's going to get me the next thing. That's not being present and really enjoying and having all the beautiful crumbs of every morsel of what you're doing now. Because if you're using what you're doing now as, you know, bait on a hook for the next thing, you're missing out, you know? So that's my thing now.
I love that image of going for the crumbs, because it's like when you get that good piece of cake, like, you don't leave that plate empty. You don't take a couple of bites and then throw it away. No, you enjoy every moment of that cake, right? Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to look at it.
Excellent.
Well, thank you so much. Oh, it's so good to see you. So good to hear you. So good to just talk to you for this time. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Patrick. It's lovely to see you. And I hope I see you again soon.
Me too. Me All too.
Right. Bye, sweetheart.
Thank you so much for joining Why I'll Never Make It. And don't forget, you can become a subscriber and get bonus conversations by going to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe, or just look for the link in the show notes. Well, that about does it for me. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and John Bartman. Be sure to join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.